Alisa Weilerstein, ending her lunchtime recital last Monday at Wigmore Hall with Kodály's Cello Sonata. Well, tomorrow, just after 1 o'clock, the violinist Patricia Kopaczynskaya will be playing music by Mozart and Enescu with the pianist Paulina Leschenko.
He really had an incredible gift for melody, and that's why the pieces are so memorable.
Renee Fleming is live from the Met in a performance of Leha's The Merry Widow next Saturday evening here on BBC Radio 3. Andrew Davis conducts Leha's most popular and enchanting work in a new production by the Broadway director Susan Stroman. The starry cast on stage includes baritones Thomas Allen and Nathan Gunn, and of course, there's soprano Renee Fleming.
The show offers riches for everyone. So beautiful.
Live from the Metropolitan Opera in Manhattan, Leha's comic operetta, The Merry Widow, next Saturday evening at 6 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now it's time for the Early Music Show. This week, Lucy Skeeping visits Hampton Court Palace to find out about some of the music which emerged during the reign of King Edward VI.
Chapel Royal Choir of Hampton Court Palace singing a simple unison plain song setting of the Te Deum. It's music that may have been performed in one of the most lavish events ever to be staged here at Hampton Court, the christening of the future King Edward VI, who was baptised here, apparently on this very spot in the Palace Chapel, on the 15th of October 1537. No one knew then, of course, that the baby, just 3 days old, this longed-for son and heir of Henry VIII, would die just a few months short of his 16th birthday, after a mere 6.5 years on the throne. And not only was Edward's a brief reign, but it was overshadowed by some of the most dramatic religious upheavals the kingdom have ever seen, which not only unsettled the population at large, but were also profoundly to alter the style of church music itself. In today's Early Music Show, I'm going to be looking at some of the musicians who served under the young King Edward VI and some of the music that came out of this time of spiritual flux. And to help me, I'm joined here in this absolutely beautiful Chapel Royal by Michelle Price, manager of the Choral Foundation, which was established to preserve and promote the unique heritage of choral music here at Hampton Court. Many thanks for joining me, Michelle.
Thank you.
Now, we're standing at one end of this beautiful building. The interior is sort of simply sparkling, of course, at this time of the year with candlelight. And it's not quite, though, is it how it would have looked in Edward's time?
No, it's not. And indeed, what you'd have to do is to strip back a lot of what you see today, apart from this Tudor ceiling, which is as it would have been in Tudor times.
With the most lovely little gold stars on a dark blue background.
That's right, with putty all over the ceiling and everywhere proclaiming Henry VIII's right to be king, Dieu et mon droit. At that stage, it would have been much more like a large empty space with no panelling. The panelling is something that's put in much later by Christopher Wren, with carvings by Grindling Gibbons. So this would have looked much more like, for instance, the Great Hall here at Hampton Court. No seating and no pews.
So where exactly did the baptism take place? Because from where I'm standing, there's no font.
No, that's absolutely right, Lucy. Well, we're standing here just in front of the altar in the Chapel Royal, and this is where we understand that the baptism itself took place. And although we do have a font here in the Chapel Royal, that's a much later addition. And my understanding is that a font was specially made and brought into the chapel for this very, very important baptism, possibly made of silver. And where we're standing now, just in front of the altar, is where that would have taken place.
Of course, this was the moment Henry VIII had been dreaming of for so long. His third wife, Jane Seymour, had finally succeeded where the previous two had failed in producing a boy child on 12th of October, 1537. Presumably Henry was here, part of the baptism party. Was he watching at all?
Well, in fact, he wasn't actually here in the Chapel Royal when the baptism itself took place. Although we don't exactly know where he might have been, elsewhere in the palace or perhaps out in his hunting grounds, the fact is that the tradition at that time was not for the parents to attend the baptism of their child. The Queen, of course, was ill at this stage, but Henry wasn't here.
So it was the godparents, really, who took the main role.
That's right. The godparents, that was a very important role, and perhaps exemplified here most importantly by the fact that Archbishop Cranmer, as the godfather of the future king, and his half-sister Mary, as his godmother, were here, also with his half-sister Elizabeth, but the parents were not.
So for the 3 days immediately after Edward's birth, the whole focus of the Kingdom of England, I guess you could say, was on this palace leading up to that great christening day. And it was a pageant that must have been not only political, but presumably very stage managed, almost like a bit of performance art, with all the very important people here.
Absolutely, and how they managed to pull it together in such a short amount of time with all the richness of robes and feasting is incredible to think in terms of these days when one is organising a christening of your own child, how long these things take to prepare. The fact that they did it in such a short period of time and that it was such a huge occasion, very well attended, a procession making its way through the palace of some 300 or 400 people.
They loved their processions, didn't they, the Tudors?
I think it's fair to say that Henry VIII was very fond of pageantry and ritual and the richness of clothing and everything that went with a big event. That's something that he'd been involved in and fascinated with even from a very small child. And now was his opportunity to do the same for his son.
So on every level, this was a really important event. Mind you, with all this pomp and ceremony going on, we mustn't forget, as you said, that poor Queen Jane Seymour was still in her bedchamber. It wasn't the custom for the mother to be present, but anyway, she was so incredibly ill after giving birth, and of course, 9 days after the christening, she was dead. Michelle, there are various speculations as to what exactly it was that caused Jane Seymour's death. I guess it seems likely now that it was something to do with a retained placenta which became infected. Although at the time, I know that some people blamed it on her pregnancy cravings for quails and cucumbers, which sounds pretty medieval, yes. But whatever the reason, it was a terrible blow and Henry was obviously devastated. How did they deal with it?
Well, he was completely devastated, moving from a moment of huge joy and celebration to one of complete desolation at the loss of his queen. So much so that we understand that where you and I are standing here now, Lucy, he had his wife brought here and laid in state for everyone to come and see that the queen was dead. In order to make that happen, her innards had had to be removed and she had been embalmed in some way. And our understanding is that her heart and the rest of her viscera were placed in a lead casket under the altar where we're just standing. Oh, yes.
Well, I suppose, however devastating his third wife's death may have been, Henry must have taken some consolation in the fact that at least he now had a son and heir.
Thank you.
David Skinner conducted the voices of Magdala in Nicholas Ludford's antiphon Ave Cuius Conceptio. Hail, thy conception abounded in solemn joy. You're listening to the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. And today I'm at Hampton Court Palace, looking at music surrounding the short but eventful life of King Edward VI. Now, his father, Henry VIII, was an extremely musical monarch. We know he played quite a number of different instruments, had a good singing voice and certainly strut his stuff on the dance floor. So, no doubt, the young Prince Edward would have grown up in a musical environment. And, of course, he would have heard music in the chapel services. Michelle, you're the manager of the Choral Foundation here at Hampton Court Palace. How different do you think the institution was back then?
At that stage, the Chapel Royal was a group of musicians and priests that followed the royal household wherever it went around the country, and indeed, in the case of Henry VIII, onto the field of cloth of gold. For the musicians, it was very much a peripatetic life, because to meet the spiritual needs of the monarch, they would, perhaps even at a moment's notice, have to travel throughout the kingdom in a very large group, and obviously all their physical needs would need to be met. I expect it's very much like today when a national orchestra goes on tour and arrives at Heathrow Airport with boxes and boxes of instruments and music.
Would the Chapel Royal have all lived in the palace, or would it have been more like today that they were kids who came in from outside?
I think then they lived together as a group, and quite often it was a family institution where fathers worked with sons and then themselves became choristers or musicians. And in fact, I understand that in those times it was very likely that a boy could be pressed into service as a chorister. So if he were, for example, skipping down Creek Road across the bridge whistling a merry tune, he might be taken to Hampton Court and told, "You're going to be a chorister, young man." These days we're not quite as cruel, and we do it in a rather civilised method by having an open day, a day when local boys from schools in the surrounding area can come and see what life is like as a chorister at Hampton Court Palace.
Well, we're going to hear some music by Thomas Tallis next. He became a gentleman of the Chapel Royal in 1542, in fact, when Henry was still on the throne and Prince Edward was about 5 years old. Do we know what the day-to-day life of, say, a composer working with the Chapel Royal and specifically for the king would have been? Would he have lived in?
I think he would, but I think it would have been a very hard life, Lucy. There's nothing to say that the composers and musicians enjoyed the comforts of life here at the palace. There's nothing of an ensuite facility, I think, for the musicians. They really were very much down the pecking order. And I understand in a lot of instances went unpaid or certainly had to struggle to get payment for their work.
Well, of course, by the time of Edward's birth, Henry had already got divorced, both from his first wife and from the Vatican and Rome itself. And yet, at this stage, at least, much of the liturgy and the church traditions remained in the same Catholic vein, as we'll hear next. This is a Latin motet, Alleluia Pro Nobis.
Thank you.
Thomas Tallis' antiphon Alleluia Pro Nobis, sung there by Chapelle du Roi, conducted by Alistair Dixon. In 1547, when Prince Edward was just 9 years old, his father, Henry VIII, died, and England cried, "Long live King Edward." Henry's will named 16 executors who would act as Edward's counsel until he reached the age of 18, which included his uncle Edward Seymour, who became Lord Protector of the realm. Of course, it's likely that members of the council rallied and vied for control of the young king in order sometimes to manipulate him to further their own ends. Meanwhile, Edward was still receiving his formal education, which it seems included musical tuition. The composer Christopher Tye, who had been a favourite of King Henry, was engaged at court as a sort of musical advisor and a tutor to Edward. Tye was clearly held in high regard. Edward was even reported as quoting his father as follows: "England, one God, one truth, one doctor hath for music's art, and that is Dr. Tye, admired for skill in music's harmony."
Thank you.
In Pace Id Ipsum by Christopher Tye, sung there by Cambridge University Chamber Choir, directed by Timothy Brown. You're listening to The Early Music Show here on BBC Radio 3. I'm Lucy Skeeping, and I'm at Hampton Court Palace today, finding out about some of the music and musicians from the reign of King Edward VI. Michelle, it's interesting, because we think of Edward's father, Henry VIII, as, in a way, the first Protestant. But in terms of music and ceremony and even liturgical language, things hadn't changed very much, had they?
No, that's right. In fact, people think that Henry VIII was the first Protestant king, but I think that's a title that's more properly attributed to Edward VI. Although Henry had had a very public and well-documented break with Rome, he continued to practice as a Catholic and worship as a Catholic until the day he died, worshipping several times a day, not necessarily here in the chapel, but elsewhere in his private rooms.
Now, there were no seats here in the chapel, where the people stood up, and the king, I expect, was up in the gallery overseeing it all?
That's right. This is what we call the Holy Day Closet, sometimes colloquially called the Royal Pew, but that is where the king would have sat, and in Tudor times with glass across the front of it. And down here in the main chapel, all the courtiers and members of the court would have been packed in, making sure that they were seen by the king, no doubt. And he would have been taking advice from his ministers during the course of the service, but keeping an eye on what was happening down here.
It does have the feel of a very grand royal box with the coat of arms above, as if he's almost a sense of theatre, which there still was.
Absolutely. I think ritual and theatre and majesty were all part of it. And my understanding is that Henry VIII did not come down to the floor of the chapel, except possibly on the occasion of the Epiphany, when there was some sort of procession that took place, which he headed.
Now, I know that once Edward became king, although he was obviously very young and he had his advisers, he took quite a lot of interest in religious matters. But the architects of the great reforms to finally do away with the Latin Mass was Thomas Cranmer, Archbishop of Canterbury.
Archbishop of Canterbury.
How did that work?
That's right. So you'll remember that Archbishop Cranmer was his godfather at his baptism and is a huge influence throughout his life. Edward VI, although a young monarch, is determined to be a good Protestant king and to bring about reforms that he perhaps felt that his father hadn't succeeded in doing so. He also disliked the Catholicism of his half-sister Mary and therefore did much to remove the decoration and the ceremony and the colour from not only the vestments and the clerical wear, but also introduced something which would have been seen as very controversial in the Catholic Church, which was to allow priests to marry.
And it was thanks to Cranmer's influence, wasn't it, that composers began to write church music in English rather than Latin, hence the Book of Common Prayer.
That's right. The Book of Common Prayer was introduced in 1549, and we know by 1550 that composers such as Marbeck were setting the prayer book on a basis that had not been done before. This was removing the Latin liturgy and the polyphony and making things much simpler, having the liturgy in English so that everybody could understand what was being said.
And crucial, from the sort of musical style point of view, was this business of one syllable to one note as far as possible. That means so that you don't have one word spread out over many, many notes, so you can hardly remember what the word was by the time you get to the end. This was perhaps nearer the patterns of speech, so people could understand. That's correct.
Nearer the patterns of speech and clear, so that the congregation would be understanding the words that were being used and could, of course, join in. If you like, a precursor to what we have today as a congregational hymn. The principle was one of bringing clarity to music and to enhance and amplify the words of worship.
So let's hear a little bit of what the composer Christopher Tye made of Cranmer's and indeed Edward's reforms. This is the anthem, Praise Ye the Lord, Ye Children.
Thank you.
Bill Ives, directing the choir of Magdalen College, Oxford, in that anthem Praise Ye the Lord Ye Children by Christopher Tye, who was thought to have been a music tutor to the young King Edward VI in the 1540s. We don't quite know when that piece was composed, but it seems likely it was during the reign of Edward when the reformations to church liturgy gave rise to Archbishop of Canterbury Thomas Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer in 1549, which included the complete forms of service for daily and Sunday worship in English. Well, another composer who became a gentleman of the Chapel Royal at this time was a man called Richard Farrant, who's said to have joined the Chapel Royal in about 1550. He spent 12 years in the job, during which time he took part in funerals for Edward VI and Mary I and coronations of Mary and Elizabeth. In fact, he also had a career outside the church. He wrote a number of successful English dramas and founded the first Blackfriars Theatre, which was on the north side of the Thames, opposite more or less where the Globe is today. Farrant was also the first composer to write English verse anthems, like this one, Lord, for thy tender mercy's sake, the Cambridge Singers, conducted by John Rutter. John Rutter conducted the Cambridge Singers in the verse anthem Lord for Thy Tender Mercy's Sake by Richard Farrant, gentleman of the Chapel Royal during the 1550s. Well, I'm now in the Great Hall here at Hampton Court. It's decked out now, anyway, for visitors as a sort of banqueting hall with refectory tables and an open fire in the middle. It's all very medieval with wonderful tapestries around the walls and light pouring in through the stained glass windows. Michelle, what went on here in this large hall? It was by no means just eating, was it?
I think it was more living and sleeping and everything else, really. Our understanding is that this hall would have been a place of recreation and rest for all the people who worked in the palace, including the musicians and choristers, who would have come here to gather, to eat, to share their stories, share their music, and perhaps bemoan their poor and lowly status within the court.
Now, you're the manager of the Choral Foundation here at the palace, and I'm thinking about the congregations as they listened to this new kind of Englishified church music. I mean, were they in some kind of a shock? Or did the composers and the listeners find it rather refreshing? Or perhaps there were accusations of dumbing down, as we might say today?
I guess we won't really know, but I think it must have been a time of great change, and I think perhaps introduced slightly more slowly than we imagined, and it would have filtered out from the court throughout the land. So it would have taken some time for ordinary people to experience that change if you think about those worshipping at the Chapel Royal, would have been the people that were important to the court and to the king. But it was certainly a time of change and a time when perhaps the worship and the form that it took suddenly became more accessible to the person who was no longer just a bystander. They could both understand and perhaps join in some of what was happening. It was no longer just in Latin, it was in English, and the form of music, which was much simpler.
Well, we're fighting to some extent with a wonderful guide and a large party over at one end of the hall. So I think it's time for some music. Now, along with Tallis and Farrant, who we've already heard, there was another composer here in service as gentleman of the Chapel Royal during Edward's time in the 1550s. And his name was John Shepherd, who wrote liturgical compositions both in Latin and indeed as well here in English.
Thank you.
John Shepherd's Christ Rising Again, sung there by Stile Antico. You're listening to the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. And today's programme is from Hampton Court Palace. Well, I've now climbed the rather grand stairs at the back of the Royal Chapel, and we're on the balcony, a sort of royal box that overlooks the chapel. Michelle Price, is this where the royal family, Henry and indeed his son Edward, would have sat every day for the services?
That's right. This is the Holy Day closet where the king would have sat overlooking all of those who'd come into the chapel to worship with him. And to either side, there are smaller chapels where the queen would have worshipped and the courtiers would have attended him. And to my right-hand side, we have the Lady Day Chapel, which is still in use as a small chapel where members of the public come and worship here every morning.
So it's still very much a used building for the purposes for which it was intended.
In fact, if Edward VI came back here today and stood in this very place, apart from a lot of the changes to the decoration, not much would have changed. This is the living heart of the palace where worship takes place every day. And on Sunday, choral worship takes place according to the Book of Common Prayer and would be something he would absolutely recognise.
Now, just in front of us is a wonderful cabinet with a most enormous reproduction of a bejewelled crown. It seems unbelievable that rather sickly Edward VI would actually have been able to put that on his head.
Yes, such an incredibly heavy crown. You can't imagine this young king wearing it, unlike his father, who you could visualise wearing that with some aplomb. But I understand that this crown was used during his coronation at Westminster Abbey.
Michelle, we were talking earlier about the way the musicians had to sort of adapt the way they composed, and because the music began to alter gradually as the Protestant Rite sort of came in. Did the musicians, do we know, and the composers particularly, sort of embrace these changes with open arms, or was it a case of, well, the king wants me to do this, so I better do it?
I think these were very much jobbing musicians who relied very much on the work and wherever the whims of the current monarch took them. I think for some of them it must have been incredibly difficult to compose music which was so much at odds with their own personal beliefs.
Tallis, for instance, who was only in his early 40s when Edward came to the throne, we know he was an unreformed Roman Catholic for the rest of his life, wasn't he?
That's right, but managed somehow through subsequent monarchs, both Catholic and Protestant, to retain his head and compose some of the most beautiful choral music.
Peter Phillips directed the Tallis Scholars in that beautiful anthem by Thomas Tallis, If Ye Love Me. In early 1553, just a few months after the publication of Archbishop Thomas Cranmer's second Book of Common Prayer, the 15-year-old King Edward VI became seriously ill and a political panic ensued. Edward and his advisers were horrified at the thought that on his death, Edward's half-sister Mary would take the throne and undo all the church reforms he'd overseen. His so-called device for the succession allowed him to pass over the claims of both his half-sisters in favour of his first cousin, Lady Jane Grey, and her male heirs. On July the 1st, Edward made his final public appearance. He showed himself at his window in Greenwich Palace. 5 days later, he was dead, his last words being, "I am faint, Lord, have mercy upon me and take my spirit." Edward was buried in Westminster Abbey on the 8th of August with Reformed Rites by Thomas Cranmer. By the time of his funeral, his half-sister, Mary, had decided to take the throne for herself. Michelle, of course, is well known that Mary reverted the whole country back to Catholicism pretty quickly. So it must have been a very dangerous time.
Absolutely. I mean, music in the reign of Edward VI had meant that the Latin liturgy had come to an end. And in fact, it became illegal during his reign. And suddenly we went back to the Catholic liturgy, the Latin, the polyphony, but indeed not for that long.
It was only 5 years later that Elizabeth succeeded Mary, and then it was a sort of turnabout again, wasn't it?
We revert to Protestantism again, and for the composers throughout this period, it's one of uncertainty and turmoil. Having met the needs of the Catholic monarch, they are now having to meet the needs of a very Protestant Elizabeth I.
Well, although Edward VI only reigned for a short time as King of England, and as an incredibly young king as well, it's amazing to think that some of his religious legacy still remains today, and it certainly spawned a lot of wonderful church music. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. It's the most lovely place to be sitting chatting to you. I'm definitely going to come back here to Hampton Court.
Well, please do come and join us at one of our choral services. It's been a delight to have you here today and to share some of the magic that is the Chapel Royal Hampton Court Palace.
And, of course, the best thing about it is this continuing tradition. We're going to close the programme today with another of Tallis's pieces, composed during the reign of Edward VI. This is his anthem, A New Commandment.
Talis's A New Commandment, sung there by the Talis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. That was the last piece in this week's Early Music Show, focusing on the choral music of the Reformation under King Edward VI and his links to Hampton Court Palace. The programme was introduced by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. Well, there's more choral music in a moment in Choral Evensong, and indeed it continues at 4 o'clock in the choir, presented by Sarah Moore Beach. And Sarah is here now. What have you got, Sarah?
Oh, plenty. It's lovely to hear Lucy in the Chapel Royal of Hampton Court just then. Some of that choir's singers are joining forces with boys from Hampton School in one of the choirs that I'm featuring on the programme today. They're one of four choirs selected to take part in the international choir competition Let the People Sing. Also today at 5 o'clock, my choral classic is Dvorak's Moving Star. Stabat Mater, which he wrote after the death of his beloved daughter. And I'm going to be joined live in the studio by Rupert Goff, who's the director of the choir of Royal Holloway University, about a new collaboration with the King's Singers. So all of that kicks off in about 55 minutes' time in the choir.
Very good. Thank you very much, Sarah. Well, now, it's just gone 3 o'clock and time for Choral Evensong, which was broadcast last Wednesday from Bath Abbey. The canticles on plain song tones were composed by Arthur Wills, who was director of music at Ely Cathedral from 1958 to 1990. The anthem by William Byrd reflects the Epiphany theme of the revelation of Christ to all nations. Byrd sets words from Psalm 117, "Praise our Lord, all ye Gentiles." The service opens now with an introit for the season composed by the London-born Canadian composer Healy Whillan, who set Lawrence Hausman's poem The Three Kings.
Come in, Come in, ye kings, and kiss the feet of God. Welcome to Bath Abbey for this service of choral evensong. The abbey is set in the very heart of Bath, on a site that has been a place of Christian prayer since the 4th century. It's a parish church with a thriving congregation, and we welcome hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. Day by day, through these days of Epiphany, we pause to wonder at the mystery of God come among us. Who is this child? Can it be true that God who made the stars comes to ordinary human beings and catches them up into his wonderful story? Here we might wonder and hear the echo of those ancient words of St. John. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. The psalm set for today is Psalm